The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Last week, Supreme Court Justice Kennedy announced his retirement. A chilling panic set in as headline after headline cried, "Kennedy's retirement ensures the Supreme Court will allow states to outlaw abortion," or "what to do when, not if, Roe is overturned." Kennedy is generally considered the swing vote on the court who has tended to uphold abortion rights. Roe v. Wade, of course, was the case that ruled abortion bans are unconstitutional. I want to really focus on how the threat of losing Roe has been the siren song of mainstream abortion rights organizations to lure activists onto the rocky coast of the Democratic Party. Steering energy away from protests and speakouts and into lobbying and electoral campaigns, as my analogy suggests, that strategy is losing. Of course, after we have suffered the nonstop whiplash of horrific policies over the past year and a half especially, losing Roe feels closer than it has in a really long time. Of course, we do not want to lose the constitutional protection against going to jail for getting an abortion. But for thousands of people, we've already lost Roe. For people on Medicaid who can't borrow the money, Roe is already gone. For people who live too far from a clinic in a state without public transit. For people who will lose their jobs if they take too much time to meet the onerous counseling requirements, there is no Roe. For minors who fail to convince a judge that they are mature enough, for minors who are undocumented, or anybody tricked by a fake pregnancy clinic into thinking their pregnancy is not as far along as it actually is, so they put off getting an abortion until it's legally too late. This happens. For them, they've already lost Roe. Losing Roe would not make abortion illegal, but would leave the question to the states. Four states have automatic bans with their finger on the trigger. Eight have pre-Roe bans that could automatically return, and 10 states have vowed to ban abortion to the fullest extent possible. The anti-abortion forces have arguably more congressional power than they maybe ever have, but I believe they're unlikely to be willing to jeopardize their electoral gains by immediately ending all legal abortion. But pro-choice politicians are also unlikely to jeopardize themselves by fighting for what we really need, which is not a sliver of constitutional protection, but abortion on demand, for free, for anyone, for any reason. If Roe is not overturned, we can expect at best a continuation and acceleration of the restrictions and bans that have been happening for decades. That's if it's not overturned, and also we don't act. I just want to take a minute and talk about why this medical decision is such a controversy in U.S. politics. Conventional wisdom says abortion is always difficult and generally tragic, made out of desperation and as a last resort. In fact, Supreme Court Justice Kennedy argued that states should be allowed to limit access to abortion in order to protect women from depression and low self-esteem. But a long line of research has debunked that myth. We know there's no link between depression and abortion. 95% of women say they do not regret their abortion, so really conventional wisdom is not so wise. After all, many of you have read about the recent story about an Arizona woman who chose to take prescribed abortive medicine when the fetus she was carrying stopped developing, only to be denied at Walgreens because of the pharmacist's ethical disagreements. Which is confusing, even accepting the so-called pro-life framework, because the fetus was not going to develop anymore. This is legal in 6 states. Walgreens confirmed it as their policy to allow this. How have we gotten so far that pharmacists can and do refuse to do their jobs because their morals dictate preserving a dead fetus in the womb of a living person? The prevailing discourse on abortion has drifted far from bodily autonomy and control over one's reproductive life and is stranded on the question of when a fetus becomes a baby. It was not always this way. Before the mid-19th century, this country didn't really have any laws about abortion, but this, don't worry, is not an historical talk about laws. Instead, I saw that look on your faces. Instead, our story begins in 1965. Abortion is banned in all 50 states with limited exceptions. Illegal abortions in the 50s and 60s are estimated to have occurred as many as 200,000 to 1.2 million times every year. And even as late as 1965, illegal abortions accounted for 17% of pregnancy and childbirth-related deaths. And that is the reported number. Out of the ranks of the civil rights and anti-poverty movement sprang a women's liberation movement. The rise of the women's movement was also directly inspired by the revolutions sweeping the world at the time, especially in 1968. They organized speakouts and marches, and the movement spread across the country. For the first time, people who suffered clandestine and even dangerous illegal abortions could come out of the shadows and share their experiences, creating a political mosaic from these personal stories. That was solidarity. The National Organization for Women was founded and became a significant player on the scene. Now called a Women's Strike for Equality on August of 1970 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the day women won the right to vote. Now, different forces in the movement vied for different demands for the day. The liberal section of the movement limited to their demands the legal right to abortion, childcare, equal employment opportunities. The radical forces agreed generally, but also fought for free abortion on demand, free 24-hour community-controlled childcare, and equal pay for equal work. Without these qualifications, they argued, the demands would fall short of what working women and their families need to truly exercise those rights. State by state, the movement scored victories of decriminalization, and in 1973, the Supreme Court decided Roe v. Wade, holding that a right to privacy under the 14th Amendment, extended to the decision to have an abortion. However, that individual privacy right must be weighed against the state's interests, which are both in protecting women's health and also protecting the potential life of a fetus. In short, as the pregnancy develops, the weight shifts in favor of protecting the fetus. Still, it was a sweeping triumph for the abortion rights movement. Make no mistake, it was won by the movement. Opinions changed dramatically during this period. In public opinion, the movement's impact was much larger than its activist base. Within other movements, support for abortion grew. The Young Lords added to their platform community control over abortion, safe, legal access. Black Panther Party initially opposed abortion as a tool of genocide. By 1975, they were firmly pro-choice. The lessons I want to draw from the movement, from this abortion rights movement, were that abortion was part of a broader platform. They wanted repeal of laws, not reform of laws. Their demands were based on their lives, not on the policy, the expert opinions of policymakers. Out of this movement grew the mainstream organizations we know today, specifically NOW and NARAL, both of which have done really important work for abortion rights. But these organizations also have for decades looked to the Democrats for protection, and the Democrats have looked away. In 1976, the Hyde Amendment blocked federal Medicaid funding for abortion services. Since 1994, there have been very narrow exceptions. This amendment has passed and passed and passed and passed until today, still today. Today, Medicaid provides coverage to 1 in 5 women of reproductive age. I couldn't find data on trans folks and non-binary folks who are on Medicaid, but given the immense repression of transgender people in this country, we can safely assume the number is very high. Come back to 1981. A right-wing celebrity is elected to the White House. The election of Ronald Reagan invigorated anti-choice zealots. This new right developed a strategy of scapegoating women and minorities as part of reversing the hard-won gains of the 60s and 70s social movements, and abortion was no exception. What is more, anti-abortion zealots were attacking clinics, physically attacking clinics. However, mainstream abortion rights organizations were actively demobilizing the pro-choice movement. In place of grassroots speakouts and marches, the organizations installed lobbyists, pollsters, campaign managers. What is more, the organizations turned away from abortion rights supporters and toward the middle ground. This turn would prove ruinous for the movement. As one example, in 1986, Arkansas proposed an amendment to its constitution that would have banned abortion subsidies. Mind you, federal funding, if you remember the Hyde Amendment, had already banned that. Arkansas, as a state, also did not provide abortion funding. But the amendment would have codified into the constitution anti-abortion language. Initially, the majority of voters supported the amendment. Abortion rights organizations poured time and resources into focus groups to discover where people were, to meet people where they already were, basically tailing people's thoughts. They discovered that right-wing voters that supported the amendment could not be won to arguments about women's rights. In fact, they decided not to say women or to say rights. But those voters hated big government. And I want to quote from Bearing Right, How Conservatives Won the Abortion War. I cannot recommend this high enough. Confronted by this latent coalition of pro-life, anti-government, anti-tax, anti-welfare, anti-black voters, abortion rights activists had two choices. They could declare war against all of these constituencies in the name of a broad liberal agenda, or they could divide the coalition and isolate pro-life voters by seducing other constituencies. NARAL chose the latter. Its campaign message against this amendment was a simple question: who decides? The implication, of course, was that the government should not invade the private decisions of families, and the campaign highlighted the fact, they really were proud of the fact, that Arkansas already doesn't fund abortions, so the amendment was unnecessary. Now, I want to say this one more time. They argued against an amendment that would ban funding for abortion by arguing against state intervention and assuring voters that the state already didn't fund abortion. This did defeat the amendment. But the tactic of catering to the middle ground won that battle. But as time would show, the strategy of capitulating to people who wanted to keep their guns and wanted to not live next to black people would be a disaster in the war for abortion rights. Campaign after campaign, NARAL kept this strategy, this framework of who decides, which allowed the so-called pro-choice Democrats to also support parental consent laws and come out as anti-funding. NARAL political constituents wrote the NARAL Guide for Candidates and Campaigns, published in 1990. Its first chapter told candidates how to deliver the message, which was to frame the issue as a matter of keeping the government out of personal decisions. According to the manual, the Who Decides framework attracted 60% of the voters in the middle. They were attracted to this message because it represented a conservative position of government non-interference, avoided the drawbacks of feminism, and appealed to American individualism. NARAL shifted our rights to your rights. You decide. We, you, I. Instead of women, poor people, teenagers. Teens can't vote. Most people are not poor, and women are just half the population and not a bulk of the political power. The National Right to Life PAC answered NARAL's guide with its own guide. They echoed the question, who decides? It cited polls from 1989 showing 70% support for parental consent laws, 61% support for opposing public funds, 61% supported mandatory notice to husbands. Then the guide explained that candidates could use the language of choice to promote these restrictions. If women have rights, so do men, fathers, parents, taxpayers. The winning question, who decides? As the author puts it, each side in its resolve to defeat the other has enlisted the aid of pro-family, anti-tax voters who worship neither life nor choice. Pro-choice activists have advertised government non-interference as a way to protect the rights of husbands and parents to participate in abortions. Pro-life activists have promoted consent and notification laws on the same grounds. Pro-choicers have defended abortion as a means of preventing additional births and welfare expenses. Pro-lifers have attacked abortion by framing it as a welfare expense. In short, activists on both sides have sold their policies to voters as a means to safeguard not the rights of women or unborn fetuses, but of husbands, parents, businesses, and taxpayers. This is where the debate was happening. So the mainstream abortion rights strategy was winning the battle of defining abortion as an issue of choice. It was losing the war of defining choice. Moreover, by refusing to directly address abortion as a fundamental right, they let the right-wingers define it as murder. The pro-choice movement, also from this book, the pro-choice movement had reached the summit of victory, stripped of the cumbersome weight of much of their agenda. They had conquered the middle ground, and the middle ground had conquered them. This family framework ensures today. The line on Planned Parenthood's website about the Hyde Amendment says, when insurance coverage provides for all pregnancy-related health care except abortion, it interferes with the private health decisions that are best left to the woman, her doctor, and her family. Meanwhile, back to the 1980s and 90s, as courts and politicians were debating how much regulation was enough regulation, the battles outside the clinics raged. Between 1977 and 89, 77 family clinics were firebombed, 117 were targets of arson, 250 received bomb threats, 231 were invaded, 224 were vandalized. Anti-abortion protesters swarmed clinic facilities, determined to shut them down. Operation Rescue, led by a white 26-year-old used car salesman, declared the use of civil rights-era tactics of peaceful disobedience to save the unborn children. There was nothing peaceful about their tactics or the goal of reversing the right to control one's own reproductive life. The abortion rights movement responded in different ways. I won't go into too much detail about clinic defenses organized by socialists in the 70s and 80s. That's what Michelle will talk about. I will, however, give an overview so we can understand the moment in context. The left wing of the feminist movement, including socialists, including our very own Sharon Smith, so if you see her this weekend, ask her all about it, formed abortion clinic defense groups. NARAL helped form escorts for patients. I want to say escorting was and is a very valuable service, but what was needed in addition was a large, confident, visible presence to counter the growing right. That growing right posed a physical and a political threat. The mainstream abortion rights organizations relied heavily on injunctions, legislation, and police to keep the clinics open. One of the largest anti-choice mobilizations happened in 1991 in Wichita, Kansas, when thousands of Operation Rescue bigots descended on the clinic during their Summer of Mercy. The moderate wing of the pro-choice movement didn't want a confrontation with the anti-abortionists, and they said, rely on the police to do their job. This was what the pro-choice leadership in Wichita did. No protests were organized, and Operation Rescue successfully shut down the clinic for weeks. After Wichita, pro-choice activists would not repeat their mistake. The slogan of the movement was "No More Wichitas." When Operation Rescue went to Buffalo, New York, they were met with bitter, pathetic defeat. Now, I don't want to step on Michelle's toes, but I will give you a little teaser. Hundreds of abortion rights activists thwarted Operation Rescue, and the clinic stayed open. By week's end, the new president of NOW made an appearance in Buffalo, saying to a CNN reporter, "We support clinic defense. We have seen this is a strategy that works." In other circumstances, the mainstream abortion rights orgs have, at times, been very successful at mobilizing protests. In 89, with George H.W. in the White House and the Supreme Court deliberating how much interference with abortion rights was too much, NOW called on supporters to come to Washington, D.C., a call that 500,000 people answered. The Supreme Court upheld anti-choice law, but also, the conservative justices who sided with maintaining legal abortion explicitly referenced in their opinion the general consensus that had developed on the issue, something symbolized by most of all the mass abortion rights marches. A few years later, another march of 500,000 pro-choicers came to D.C., showing the incredible potential to galvanize that kind of protest movement that could defend rights. However, between 92 and 2004, there were no such national marches called. Why? It's because the anti-abortion movement stopped attacking women. I'm just kidding. They didn't. We already discussed that. Just making sure you're paying attention. In fact, the anti-abortion movement rallied tens of thousands of people in D.C. every January 22nd on the anniversary of Roe. Unfortunately, in 92, the Supreme Court upheld Casey v. Planned Parenthood. Boo. Saying the legal right to abortion is protected, but the material ability to exercise that right is not protected. So you have the legal right to get one. Someone else has the legal right to interfere with that to a certain extent. Bill Clinton ran on a pro-choice platform, but during his 8 years in office, abortion restrictions were passed in state after state after state, more than the presidencies of Reagan and George Bush Sr. combined. When Mr. Pro-Choice Clinton broke his campaign promise to pass the Freedom of Choice Act, the pro-choice movement did not mobilize. But do not fret. In his second term, he promoted abstinence among teens to lower abortion rates. And Hillary Clinton forged alliances with anti-abortion forces on common ground, such as rejecting the extremism of the abortion rights of the pro-choice movement. That is, the extremism of not being sorry about wanting to get an abortion. Bill Clinton left the White House with the right to abortion more restricted than when he took office. In 2005, on the 32nd anniversary of Roe, Senator Hillary Clinton said that it is a sad, even tragic circumstance, abortion, that shouldn't ever have to be exercised, or only in very rare circumstances. Shortly after, yeah, boo, Howard Dean, who is considered a far-left Democrat, said, "Nobody is pro-abortion." And folks, before I go on, I'm gonna take a minute to disagree with Mr. Dean. I am pro-abortion. Abortion is an everyday, normal healthcare procedure that enables women to make and other people to make decisions about their lives. Let's keep following the Democrats. I gotta keep following the Democrats. Obama pledged to pass the Freedom of Choice Act. Do you remember the celebration when he passed that? No, I don't either, because it didn't happen. Instead, he extended restrictions on federal funding for abortion to apply to the Affordable Care Act. While the Hyde Amendment attacked only poor people's access to abortion, the ACA targeted all people receiving medical care from companies participating in the market, with limited exceptions that counted for just a very small percentage of abortions. In 2012, now endorsed Obama for re-election, saying his record on women's issues speaks for itself. It is not entirely clear to me what they think he said. The Democrats have for decades repeated the argument that abortion is dangerous or sad. It's inherently a moral question. And Nancy Pelosi said last year, it's a fading issue in the Democratic Party. Shifting the terms of the abortion question from autonomy to fetal protection has not existed in a vacuum. It has had real effects on real laws. Here's a sampling. There's a little sprinkling. In Alabama, minors who seek abortion without parental consent could face a court-appointed lawyer to defend the fetus, who could call witnesses to testify on the fetus's behalf. What would it say? The fetus's lawyer can also appeal a judge's decision. Texas requires cremation and burial of fetal remains. Other states have a litany of mandatory counseling, mandatory ultrasounds, and more. Let me make it very clear. Restrictions do not change the minds of the vast majority of people who terminate a pregnancy. That's because by the time you schedule the appointment, you already thought about it. Yeah. Most abortion patients are resolute in their decision and would prefer to have their abortions earlier in pregnancy. Second trimesters are more expensive, offered by fewer providers. Restrictions have caused serious harm. The Democrats' bad politics and the mainstream organizations that have prioritized campaigns over movements have left numberless people with no choice but to carry pregnancies to term, pregnancies they never wanted. Today, we see a more restricted set of abortion rights than we did in the 80s. Piecemeal abortion rights that severely limit access are hardly rights at all. And now we're facing a real threat to the constitutional right itself. So, to wrap up, what do we do? For the last 10 years, in truth, NOW and NARAL have both been practically irrelevant in comparison with Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood, on the other hand, is universally synonymous with abortion activism. They are so widely supported and have no doubt made a tremendous amount of money over the last 3 years in private donations because of all the attacks. People follow their lead. On clinic defense, the line is from Planned Parenthood is don't go. Can you imagine if instead they said, yes, come down and fight? Firebombs and threats and invasions are not a relic of the past. But even when they don't exist, when there are no bullets, harassment, degradation is normalized, and we're told we have to ignore it? Let patients face it on their own, face it privately? At the base of the Democrats' strategy for decades has been this message of privacy, my body, my choice, or my body and also the choice of my doctor and like my family, my husband, and like all these other people. In this framework, Planned Parenthood demobilizes people who want to be there to support each other. While I have the highest regard for Planned Parenthood's clinical services, we in the ISO respectfully and sharply disagree with this political strategy. First of all, it's paternalistic. It makes an artificial distinction between clinics and protesters. We are both. Second of all, letting anti-choice bigots go unopposed sends a very real political message to anyone seeking abortion. The message is that that message is a direct attack on reproductive freedom and a threat to their safety. Relying on a legal strategy of and hoping for the support of Democratic politicians has done nothing to stop this advance. Because of attacks, I already said that. Oh, it's changed also because of these attacks going unopposed. We're losing public opinion. Although about 60% of people consider themselves pro-choice, more than half of them support significant restrictions. Comrades, all is not lost. Karl Marx wrote, people make history, but not in conditions of their choosing. Truly, we have not chosen these conditions that we are facing. Nobody's coming to save us. This fight is ours, and we know from history how to lose it. We know what doesn't work. I understand if you are scared by Justice Kennedy's retirement. I'm scared too. But remember, Roe v. Wade was passed by a court with four justices appointed by Nixon. One of them wrote the opinion, two of them joined it. Not because they realized, like, they opened the Constitution and suddenly it protected women's autonomy or privacy, but because there was a mass movement pounding at the door. We are the ones hurt by abortion restrictions. We are the ones most affected by the failures of the past. We cannot put all of our eggs, that's a joke, put all of our eggs into the basket of a Supreme Court justice with a swing vote. We know the way forward. We are capable of offering real political leadership. These clinics are our clinics. Thank you.
So I procrastinated a lot in writing this talk. I'm sure none of you have ever procrastinated in writing a talk. But actually, and unfortunately, this year, my procrastination worked to my advantage because of Justice Kennedy's announcement of retirement. And I think even if I had written this talk 2 weeks ago, while the overall content would have vastly been the same, I think that the urgency and enormity of the task that is set before us has changed a little bit. And I really, really look forward to discussing the best way to keep and expand abortion access over the next days with you all and how we fight for that over the coming years. So Haley has laid out an incredibly detailed argument of how we arrived at this moment. So I want to do a couple things here today. So I want to give a brief update of state abortion access and clinic harassment and intimidation. I won't spend too long on that because it is absolutely devastating. But then I also want to discuss the history of the on-the-ground clinic defense movements that have sprung up over the last years and the history of that and how we fight for a truly inclusive, broad reproductive justice movement. And as a part of that, the task ahead. Like many of you, I come into this fight soberly, watching my entire life abortion rights slip further and further away. and the developments of the last few months of state laws limiting access to abortion, the Supreme Court's recent decision in favor of crisis pregnancy centers' right to free speech, and then this coming Supreme Court justice nomination, and what our task is as socialists to fight back. So as Haley has already mentioned, many, many, many women and people that can get pregnant already live in a post-Roe world. Abortion access continues to erode countrywide, and it's created vast abortion deserts. So in 2017, 49 abortion clinics shuttered their doors, and 32 of those were Planned Parenthood clinics. 10 of those clinics were right here in the Midwest. Abortion access remains incredibly variable across the country, and those closures will impact people who need it the most. So poor, working class, Black, Latinx, Native, and rural Americans, who are already the most impacted by restrictions like the Hyde Amendment. Also in 2014, 75% of abortion patients were considered poor or low income, and further abortion restrictions that add to the possibility of increased expenses like travel, lodging, childcare, or time off of work further places abortion outside of the reach for many. So according to the Guttmacher Institute, at least half of reproductive age people in North and South Dakota and Wyoming live more than 170 miles from an abortion clinic. And those states also have incredible legal hoops to jump through. Currently, 90% of counties are without an abortion provider. When I was looking back at the talk that I gave last year on a similar topic, that number was 88%. So year by year by year, we are seeing increased vast mileage differences in how far people are having to travel to get an abortion. In 2014, 40% of reproductive age people lived in those counties without an abortion provider. Because of these restrictions, a growing body of research shows that the number of people looking to induce their own abortions at home may be climbing. In a paper that was recently published in the journal Contraception, they found that there were over 700,000 Google searches for self-abortion over the course of a year. Those most likely to be searching for information on self-abortion tended to be younger and living in areas where there are few clinics and many restrictions. The right wing is emboldened countrywide, and I think clinic harassment and intimidation has leapt to epidemic levels. When I was writing and researching for last year and looking at the numbers for 2016 that the National Abortion Federation keeps, I found that there were 31 instances of death threats and threats of harm to clinic providers. There were 51 clinic blockades and a staggering 61,562 instances of picketing outside of clinics. To give you an overall picture of how much that's increased, in 2015, there were 21,000 instances. So jumped from 21,000 to 61,000 in 2016. And now I have even more numbers for you from 2017. And so in 2017, there were 62 death threats for abortion providers, which was double from the year before. 104 clinic blockades, double from the year before. And there were 78,144 instances of picketing outside of clinics. That's a 21% increase over the year before. In 2017, in the fall, anti-choicers invaded four clinics across the country. One of those, a clinic that I have worked in many times, about 30 minutes north of Seattle in Everett, Washington, in a coordinated attack on abortion, and they call them Red Rose Rescues, which I believe are a clear violation of the FACE Act, but no one was charged with the FACE Act violation. And the FACE Act, for those who are not aware, was national legislation that was passed in the 1990s to prohibit the types of blockades and clinic violence that Operation Rescue was engaged in. There are several clinics, especially like those in the last, in states where there is a single abortion clinic, like Kentucky and North Carolina, that have had numerous actions of hundreds strong protesters. I know there's folks from across the country, so if you live in one of those states and have seen, you know, the 600 people outside of clinics in North Carolina, I would love to hear what you guys are doing to fight back. And so the anti-choicers are gaining steam. Our clinics are literally actually under siege. I don't have a better way to describe it.
They're doubling down in every aspect of organization. They are outside our clinics. They're invading our clinics. And they're passing laws restricting abortion. And they're marching and they are building independent organization in ways that we are just not. And they show no sign of backing down. And I believe they show no sign of backing down because there's been a near complete absence of real grassroots defense of abortion rights over the last 50 years. As Haley laid out, the strategy of the large women's rights organizations and their curtailing to the Democratic Party and focus on electoralism has utterly failed. But how do we fight back? I ask this sincerely, and as someone who has been organizing for a long time, and that I don't have all of the answers. I believe the people in this room have many of the answers. So for a long time, most reproductive justice activists have understood that the right strategy has not, in fact, been to overturn Roe v. Wade. They haven't had to because their strategy to chip away at access has worked remarkably well. They also, I don't think, have had the ideological and material strength to do it. I honestly think we're in a different position today. And for the first time in my life, I sincerely fear that Roe will fall. And I think that there's a debate about that. And so I encourage people to also raise that in the discussion. I think many activists on the left and the large reproductive rights organizations like Planned Parenthood and NARAL also recognize this fact, which makes our job as socialists even more pressing in winning those who are moved to act, to direct action, independent organizations, and building a democratic movement outside of the Democratic Party. So who here in the last few years has been to a clinic defense? That's amazing. Oh my God, that's like everybody. So just give me a couple words. How did it feel to be out at a clinic defense? Just popcorn, what did it feel like? Yeah. Yeah. Fantastic. So like you, many thousands of people across the country participated in their first clinic defenses in February 2017, following a nationwide call by anti-choicers to picket outside of clinics in an effort to put pressure on lawmakers to defund Planned Parenthood. The response was overwhelming, momentum building from the massive women's marches just a few weeks before. In Seattle, we had 400 people show up at 7 o'clock in the morning to march up a giant hill. to march up a giant hill, I'll never live that one down for planning the march route, in a suburb about 30 minutes south of the city. People were busing out to the middle of nowhere on buses they had never taken before to come out to this, and it was amazing. In Minnesota, thousands braved sub-zero temperatures to stand up for abortion rights, and in New York, close to 300 counter-picketers gathered, and out of that organizing, New York City for Abortion Rights, which is one of the other grassroots organizations, was founded. And so in the weeks leading up to these grassroots actions, Planned Parenthood's political arm put out the most mind-boggling argument that we should stay home. I've been an organizer for Seattle Clinic Defense for going on 7 years, and while these arguments seemed shocking to many people encountering them, they're unfortunately the same argument that we've been having with our local Planned Parenthood affiliate since our formation. Our local affiliate sent out an email discouraging counter protesters, saying the literal words were, "Patients don't come to Planned Parenthood for a political statement, they come to receive health care." No shit. Yeah. That's why we're doing this. So their argument is nonsensical at best and insulting to its patients and healthcare providers at worst. They argue that having more people outside of a clinic is confusing and that it simply makes it appear that there are larger masses of anti-choicers out front. If I had been more organized, I would have printed out pictures of what it looks like when we're in front of a clinic, because no one can mistake our giant Trust Women banner or our giant Seattle Clinic Defense, all of us decked out in pink. Like, patients aren't stupid. They know that we're there to support them. But the other argument is that by counter-protesting, we give the anti-choicers the attention that they are seeking, and by ignoring them, they have less impact. I get to take many
breaks writing this talk to do just that. I have the unique experience of being both a clinic defender and an abortion provider who has worked inside the clinics both when there is a pro-choice presence out front and then also when there is no one there to defend us. And I can tell you that Planned Parenthood's political arm is dead wrong. Mm-hmm. As a midwife and nurse practitioner, my job on abortion procedure days was to do the initial medical intake of patients, figure out a birth control method, and give some medications. But it also ended up being a lot of counseling and talking to people about their lives and their decisions. And like Haley said, lots of people talk about abortion in this really sad and tragic way, but my job was not a sad one. I connected deeply with the people who were there to terminate a pregnancy and got to be a part of literally handing them back the rest of their lives. That is what we are doing. The days that did make me sad or the most angry were the days where my patients were deeply impacted by the anti-choice harassment and intimidation that went unchallenged most of the time. People would tell me they felt fine until they saw the anti-choicers out front who hurled insults at them, wrote in chalk on sidewalks, knocked on their windows, and tried to hand them pamphlets telling them not to kill their babies. This kind of harassment, while it's changed from the heyday of Operation Rescue, is nothing short of domestic terrorism.
Say it.
It's true. The days when we had pro-choice defenders outside, patients and my coworkers were so appreciative. They could see that they weren't alone, that someone was there willing to stand up for them, stand up for their rights, and to create a more welcoming, peaceful environment outside of our clinics. If Planned Parenthood's political arm actually asked their clinic staff and the patients what they wanted, they would find that only a small minority agree with the tactic of disengagement, and they would encourage active mobilization. But time and again, Planned Parenthood's political arm has continued to ignore the voices of actual patients and providers in favor of a strategy that has normalized the anti-choice presence outside of our abortion clinics and ceded both ideological and physical space to the right wing. I think it's important that we start talking about the differences between Planned Parenthood's line on non-engagement and the strategy of clinic defense, not in the way in which they will frame it as a personalistic or moralistic difference of opinion, but as the sharp political disagreements that they are, and as a fundamental disagreement of how to organize and how to build and how to fight. I also think it's important for us to discuss that this is not the first time these arguments have surfaced. So as Haley mentioned, there have been folks who have done clinic defense in the past. We are not the first clinic defenders. And I think the example of Wichita, when the Summer of Mercy was able to shutter George Tiller's clinic, who was then assassinated in 2010, was a huge failure on the part of pro-choice activists. And then I just wanted to flesh out some more details about what happened in upstate New York and Buffalo. And so when Operation Rescue traveled to Buffalo, they were met by an organized and dedicated clinic defense. And these folks had been organizing for years against anti-choicers. And so each morning before dawn, hundreds of clinic defenders organized by Buffalo United for Choice lined up to bar Operation Rescue from being able to gather a foothold outside of the clinic. Operation Rescue even tried moving people around to different clinics in the Buffalo and Rochester areas, but each time were met with several hundred other pro-choice defenders who were following them around. And Operation Rescue was unable to close a clinic for a single day, was unable to keep a single patient from being seen. Those comrades deserve a huge round of applause. So just 2 weeks from the start of their campaign, Operation Rescue retreated tail between their legs from upstate New York, defeated and demoralized. So it can't be understated that the single factor between Operation Rescue being successful and being handed a hearty defeat was the presence of an organized militant clinic defense. Buffalo United for Choice, they had been organizing for years ahead of time. And I think really, really important, the quote that Haley pointed to, that after seeing that clinic defense worked, the folks from NARAL said, oh, okay, we actually saw something that worked. And so I think by engaging in the struggle, we can change people's minds about what is effective. So history has helped us prove that clinic defense is a winning strategy to keep clinics open and keep patients from being harassed. There's also a lovely and lovely, wonderful history of ACT UP in New York City joining activists from WAM on clinic defense picket lines. And that solidarity is just so, so beautiful. And actually, ACT UP and WAM have counter-picketed the same clinic, or sorry, the same church that activists in New York City now are also coming to bring the fight to their door. So really exciting stuff. So we also know that our job as clinic defenders is not just to keep people from being harassed, but we also know that our actions, like all direct action, have a deep impact on those who participate in them. So this past January, Seattle Clinic Defense, we had about 100 folks come out to our local clinic, and this first-time clinic defender wrote to us about her experience. She was a part of distracting an anti-choicer who was on a bullhorn. So she was trying to talk to him about whatever so that he was not on the bullhorn. And she was joined by two other clinic defenders. And she said, this was my first clinic defense. And as I was debriefing with my husband afterwards, I found myself in tears, not from anxiety about feeling so unprepared for impromptu conversations about my faith in Jesus, not from the frustration of feeling tongue-tied, trying to reason with Christian radicals, but because I felt so supported by strangers. In particular, strangers who, because they have no uterus and won't be judged for their participation in abortions, have far less to rally for and less of a short-term stake in the game. These gentlemen with nothing in common except for showing up at the same time in the same place to support the same cause stood with me as I did my best to keep some misguided sidewalk prophets off their megaphones and made me feel far less alone. As a woman, I appreciate these individuals. As a Christian, I believe these people behaved in a more Jesus-like manner than our familiar anti-choice protesters. Yeah, that's the damn truth. So this woman experienced something important that day. She experienced something she never would have experienced had she simply stayed home and called her legislators and written thank you notes to her local clinics. She experienced strangers coming together for a common cause. She experienced solidarity from complete strangers and the power of using her voice to do something important with an immediate effect of keeping that anti-choicer from harassing patients and staff members. That is how we train people to fight back. So if you are like me, you have probably been barraged with emails this week from the mainstream feminists and reproductive rights organizations like NOW, NARAL, and Planned Parenthood regarding Justice Kennedy's retirement at the end of July. And so Kennedy was appointed by Reagan in 87 and has been this occasional swing vote and ruled in favor of Roe in the 1992 case of Casey versus Planned Parenthood. And so this case in 1992 was really part of the undoing of most of the abortion access that we have now because of really specific language that says that states can regulate abortion, but they can't place an undue burden on people. But there was no definition of what an undue burden meant. And so that's been making it, abortion inaccessible parts across most of the country because of that one ruling. So while Kennedy was overall no friend to women, LGBT folks and labor, and I think that deserves to be said, like I am not sad to see him go, but what faces us is most likely worse. He did occasionally act as this swing vote. And so Trump's new nominee is most assuredly going to be cut of the same cloth as Neil Gorsuch, the arch conservative that replaced Antonin Scalia in 2017. And so there are abortion restrictions that have been passed in the last year that some legal scholars believe could pose either a direct challenge to Roe or at least things like heartbeat bills that would make abortion almost inaccessible because fetal cardiac activity starts at about 6 weeks past a woman's last menstrual period. So we're talking about 2 weeks past a positive pregnancy test. So now the anti-tracers, the day that they have been dreaming of secretly or not so secretly, now Roe is in their crosshairs. So we are most likely going to face the most serious threat to legal abortion in this country in the coming years. That is what I really, truly believe. and the calls to action that filled my email inbox this week were milquetoast at best. I was asked to pitch in $15 to NARAL Pro-Choice Washington so they can nominate candidates who will... I know, I'll try and get through this, guys. Who will fight back with every bone in their body. And NARAL Pro-Choice America told me that I should donate money so they can build an on-the-ground response. Not that I could be the on-the-ground response, but that I needed to give them money so they could build it. My favorite one is from Now in New York City that sent out an email that said, please consider a donation and call your senators today. Tell them they must support a nominee who will uphold Roe. Our lives depend on it. I don't know about you, but call your senators doesn't quite match up with the last part of that statement. Our lives literally depend on it. Because the overturning of Roe would mean the return of widespread deaths of pregnant people dying from illegal and unsafe abortion, make no doubt about it. Planned Parenthood Federation of America sent me multiple emails telling me that my impact could be doubled, but only doubled if I was to donate by tonight and they would match my donation. So I'll leave that there. But in the last 2 years, millions, actually millions of people have protested and filled the streets on a multitude of issues since Donald Trump took power. Two of the largest ones were for women's rights and the failures of the NGOization of our political movements and now and NARAL and Planned Parenthood's political arm and their reliance on electing Democrats has frankly gotten us into this mess in the first place. On the other end of the spectrum, there have been calls from many writers, like Robin Marty, one of the authors of Crow After Roe, for people to start stockpiling Plan B, learning how to perform herbal abortions, and order and stockpile misoprostol from the internet. Surely there will be, if Roe does fall, there will be some that look to direct service organizations like the Jane Collective, who perform thousands of safe but illegal abortions right here in Chicago from 1969 until 1973. While what the Janes did was admirable and no doubt saved thousands of women's lives, engaging in direct service organizing isn't the same thing as building an organization that can put pressure on our elected officials in a way that can create change. This week, I was reminded, and I think a lot of folks around the country were reminded of an essay that Howard Zinn wrote in 2005 regarding the Supreme Court, ironically after Antonin Scalia had his congressional hearings. And I think it is true, just as true now as it was 13 years ago. He said, the right of a woman to an abortion did not depend on the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade. It was won before that decision all over the country by grassroots agitation that forced states to recognize this right. And so I think that's one of the things that we must carry forward. In the coming years, we are going to be faced with this enormous task that many of us have been engaged in, but I think we'll continue to be engaged in rebuilding from scratch a grassroots abortion rights movement. We have few models of success in recent decades to turn to in the US, but we have important lessons to learn from organizers in both Ireland and Argentina who have led multi-year campaigns to legalize abortion in their countries. I have zero time to talk about these amazing things, so I hope people will take up that history, very, very recent history and ongoing battles from the floor. And these campaigns weren't run on the basis of electing certain politicians for a certain party to win, but were grassroots campaigns that involved massive rallies, door-knocking campaigns, and a wide variety of organizations. So Adrienne Wallace, who's an Irish activist, explained the effect of the Repeal the Eighth campaign and the victory that had for her. I swear I'm almost done. She says, I remember being at the Think Left conference last year, and somebody referenced a quote from someone during the Russian Revolution. She can't remember the quote, but it referred to how everything looked different after the revolution, that places around him, although structurally still sound, looked different. And the speaker compared this to a description from a Dublin worker after a successful strike. He mentioned how She mentioned that she described coming over the hill to her home and that the city did just look different. She says, I didn't fully grasp this until the Sunday after the referendum result. I sat on my bed and all the rooftops in my estate looked different, the roads in my town, everything a different feel to it. It dawned on me later that it looked and felt different because something had changed. Not just the repeal of the eighth, but how I interact with the world. My labor and the hard work of activists around me, our collective strength, actually changed the country. I don't know what the years ahead will hold for abortion rights. Hell, I couldn't have even written this talk 2 weeks ago because of how volatile and unpredictable our world is right now. But I believe it is our job as socialists to engage as many people in the kind of activism that leaves every single one of them feeling the way that working on the campaign to repeal the Eighth Amendment in Ireland had on the activist I quoted above. As we see in the rise of anti-choice activism, we've also seen a large rise in the far right overall, and we can look to those movements to push back the far right into the shadows for some guidance. We know that ignoring the right wing on our campuses or outside of our clinics isn't going to make them go away. We also know that small bands of provocateurs looking to physically fight the right or anti-choicers is not going to strengthen our movement overall. What we need is a broad coalition united under the banner of reproductive justice that will mobilize not just for the not just to defend abortion rights, but will call for the abolition of ICE and the abolition of prisons and an end to police brutality and violence. This movement will fight for black women dying at 4 times the rate of white women in childbirth, and it will fight for unions and for equal pay. A movement that truly embraces the ideas of reproductive justice will do all of these things because we recognize that abortion rights, just like the Young Lords, just like the Black Panthers realized, is just one piece of the whole that people need in order to lead full, meaningful lives. What do abortion rights matter if our young black people are being gunned down by police and vigilantes and their mothers have no faith that the babies they birth will reach adulthood safely? What do abortion rights matter if a family in Honduras has to flee incredible violence that at its root stems from American imperialism and they will then be separated and detained at the border? So as socialists, try as we might, we cannot will this movement into being, but as more and more people realize that they need to be a part of building and rebuilding that movement, we can be there to help people realize the power in their actions and their voices. We need to be there to pull together all of these struggles that we know are interconnected, and we need to be there to project the idea that alone we are sure to lose, but together we have not just our bodily autonomy, but a world to win.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.